Today, on Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, we have with us Grace Rahmani, who is a prolific, absolutely prolific blockchain author and blockchain enthusiast, DAO enthusiast, and we'll get into what a DAO is, decentralized autonomous organization. And you've been doing some really interesting stuff about with all of these things, not to mention just being a general overall humanist and technologist. And you've kind of managed to combine those two. Grace, can we get a little background before we jump in here?
Sure. And just to say, like, I don't consider myself an enthusiast. I'm much more of a critic. And, you know, it's crazy, isn't it? People put enthusiast on their LinkedIn profile. Like, I'm a blockchain enthusiast. Since when has your enthusiasm been a professional credential? So, I don't know. but yeah, I got into blockchain really quite accidentally because I had been working since the Arab Spring with a couple of friends on this thing that we were calling, I can't even remember what we called it. It was like collaborative democracy. I can't remember what we were calling about, but like, what would it look like to rework democracy? Because I'm Israeli, and when my neighbors, you know, overthrew the dictatorships, I thought that's great, but democracy is not looking so great, looking a little bit rusty. Maybe we could fix some things up. And so I went, some of my friends said, you need to do an ICO. And I was like, what's an ICO? And he said, oh yeah, you just write this white paper thing and then you can raise $30 million just out of thin air. And I thought, that sounds implausible. And it turned out that that happens. I didn't manage to raise that much money, but I did get involved in the industry. And I started by writing because at the time I was a digital nomad. My children had grown up, so I took the opportunity to travel around the world a bit. And I needed a profession that was going to pay me while I was moving around. And writing these white paper things, well, I've been a professional writer for 30 years. I could learn how to write one of these. And within 10 days of putting up a website, I had clients from all over the world.
Wow. Wow. By the way, and I think for those listening, an ICO is initial coin offering, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. It's now an old-fashioned concept. It was when... If that's how Ethereum came out, basically they said, we're going to issue these tokens and people can pay for them. And they raised, the people would pay them money. And then they had money in order to develop this system. And then over time, that's how many of these coin offerings go, is they say, okay, we're going to issue a coin. You give us some money, you'll get some of these tokens, which at the beginning are worth nothing. And then they will be worth something over time. It's kind of ironic. We're talking on the day that the SEC chair is being grilled by Congress about his relationship with crypto. So it's very funny to be talking about initial coin offerings today.
That's for sure. That's for sure. So when we talk about sort of these initial coin offerings, again, let's lay down a little bit of a base before we jump into some of the more advanced and interesting topics that you've got going on. When we're talking about these initial coin offerings and blockchain. Basically, blockchain is effectively a digital ledger, right? Where mm-hmm. where you can inscribe something, and then it's basically backed up by cryptography, meaning that it's effectively unchangeable going forward. So it's sort of an append-only type of log. And then beyond that, initial coin offering is an offering, basically, it's basically a math problem, but basically offering these math problems as tokens representing some form of fiat currency and hoping that the value of those go up in the future. Is that all right? Did I miss anything there?
You said it in a pretty technical way, but
I think maybe I did.
Basically, the idea of money just in general, like for humans, is we don't think about it. It's like, oh, money was always with us. And that's not true. Money was not part of humanity for most of humanity's existence and for most peoples of the world. People kept account in their heads. They lived, or they didn't really keep account. They just shared what they had. I mean, but it's just anything you and I agree upon is worth something. And we all use the money we use is because we trust the government. But if you and I just, I mean, you know, not so long ago, you'd write a little piece of paper when you went to the shop next door, and when your paycheck came, you'd pay it, and you just write it down because you trusted each other. And so blockchain is actually an international way of doing that, of having a ledger, because we can all see the account we can all agree, oh yeah, you know, David owes Grace or Grace owes David, because everybody could see where that money is. And so any symbolic piece of anything could be money. And blockchain actually just provides a technology for human beings to do that on a very large scale, which was never possible before. We needed these central banks, and now all of a sudden we don't, which is like back to the SEC chair, right? All of a sudden you've got people saying, hey, we don't need the federal government to give us a symbol that says it's money. We could just do that ourselves. And it's no wonder that the governments of the world are saying, well, that's illegal. And it really questions this line of, what do you mean by illegal? What is my right to privacy? What is my right to transact? And the reason these things have become illegal really is because of money laundering. And they say, well, we wouldn't like you to not pay taxes. Okay, fine. And we wouldn't like you to do human trafficking, for example. But is that a reason to take away the rights of everybody who is honest? I've always paid my taxes and I've never been involved in criminal activity. And so why does the government have the right to tell me how to transact? I mean, they definitely have the right to arrest me if I do something wrong. But just moving money around without telling the government that I'm moving money around is not, it shouldn't be an illegal action. It is now, by the way. You're not allowed to just go withdraw more than, it depends where you are, 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000, either euros or dollars, because the governments have made it illegal for you to take out your own money from your bank account. And that's pretty bizarre. And people seem to not wince about that. Like, oh, I can only take out this much per day. Like, does it bother you?
Especially I would say in the US, where the laws, it's an odd thing, because there are preemptive laws in other countries. They don't really exist in the United States. They do for some things, but it's very small corners of the law where it's like they can take preemptive action to stop you from actually breaking the law. But yeah, the fiscal policy in the US is one of those weird areas where you're like, wait, you can't stop me from doing something illegal. Like, you have to actually, like, you can put me in jail once I've done it, but you can't physically stop me from doing this other thing, because that's sort of the choice. And there, I think that exists, like I think you can plan a burglary and then never go through with it and you didn't commit a crime. I don't think it's that way for like something very serious like murder. I think you know, you can get in trouble for just planning, like conspiracy to commit or whatever. But you're right. I mean, if something as innocuous, again, as I went to the extremes there, but something as innocuous as like moving some money around, it seems an odd thing that we have such problems being like, well, it's my money. Why can't I do what I want with it? Who's to say whether or not this is illegal? Why would it be illegal for me to do this if I'm not engaged in illegal activity, right?
Yeah, and it's connected to your right to privacy. And you know, I mean, some of the examples are very mundane. You know, when I was little, my kids were little, you know, you never wanted to be caught without a pacifier that you could stick in the baby's mouth if it's crying. And so I had a collection all over the house, and my husband didn't like that I was always buying more of them. You know, so I bought those in cash so my husband wouldn't know that I'd bought another collect, because I was always losing them, or, you know, and when the kid's crying, you got to have, right? It's just it's my right to not have my husband know how many times I lost my water bottle for the gym. And it's quite innocuous.
I couldn't agree more. And yet at the same time, we're facing some pretty strong backlash. Now, again, just like anything else that people want to ban for one reason or other, there are legitimate concerns, right? There are money laundering concerns. There are human trafficking concerns. I mean, there are definitely some things that are illicit that go on there, and they do it because the supervision is either non-existent or really difficult. So you're always going to have people in that area. But at the same time, yeah, again, we end up in this really bizarre conundrum. It's like, but do the 1% of people who are doing this ruin it for the 99%, right?
Well, also you have to recognize the effectiveness of anti-money laundering laws, which we've had around for 25 years. And anti-money laundering laws catch about 0.7% of the money laundering. You know, you get things like the Panama Papers or something, right? So if something is 99.3% ineffective, why are you expanding it out to the crypto world? I mean, it doesn't work in the banking regulation world. Everybody's got Cayman Islands things and the people with, and then it's like trafficking of arms and those kinds of things. I mean, the big arms traffickers are the countries. It has nothing to do with real concern about whether people are dying.
For sure. Actually, do you want to dive into the Panama Papers for a second? I feel like,
I
feel like this was, because the thing is, I feel like that was buried and that a lot of people are just completely unfamiliar with what happened there. And it's like, this was an international monster of a story, and it just,
disappeared.
It didn't get it. Yeah. It just disappeared for obvious reasons. Of course, once you actually understand what was in the Panama Papers, you want to dive in there for a sec?
I'm not an expert in the Panama Papers, but I think that this does speak a lot about what it means to live in a democracy, right? We vote for these people every 4 years and we think that's democracy, and we don't bother to read a newspaper. It doesn't seem to bother us that our newspapers have gotten more and more biased, that Google gives us search results that are manipulated by and influenced by. I mean, the Twitter files is another example, right? Here's the FBI influencing what you get to see. And the Panama Papers is another example of basically every single lawmaker and just about everywhere in the world being caught with some Cayman Islands or Panama in this case, companies that where they were laundering their money. And, this is one of the places where I admire Trump for like basically being like, I don't pay taxes. You know, rich people don't pay taxes. And he's just saying the truth. And these Panama Papers really exposed that as the truth, but people just step over it, and it's the media story for a day, and then we think we have a democracy. But if you don't spend your time keeping informed about that, and I was surprised at the number of people who really don't know, educated people who don't know the level of corruption that was exposed or even have even heard of the Panama Papers. And you know, I don't know what this was 4 years ago or whatever, but how can you really have any type of democracy or with people who are completely uninterested in knowing what their government is actually doing?
A reasonable question. I think that's a very reasonable question. And the answer is, I'm not sure. But this sort of leads into how would we go about fixing some of these things? Because you've done some, I mean, you have something called the Priceless DAO, and there's been some really interesting things on your end that you've been sort of experimenting with what I would argue is sort of the alchemy of technology and democracy, and kind of mushing those things together in various ways and seeing like what works and what doesn't. You want to dive in there a bit? Because it seems like, again, democracy is an interesting thing, but if we've lost trust in certain institutions, or for that matter, certain institutions have stopped trusting us, it seems like it is possible for technology to maybe take some lead on this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a little bit sad about what I remember when we were first exposed to social media and all this collection of our data. And I remember saying out loud, you know, it's a little bit pathetic that the best thing that this technology can think of to do with our data is sell us more stuff. Unfortunately, that's not the case today, right? Like we really saw right now, we're seeing our health impinged on. We're seeing people being, you know, swayed in elections all over the world. We're just seeing now our data collected and ourselves manipulated into taking one side or another on a war, which is destructive to everybody. We're seeing important information being censored from both mainstream. And it's just horrifying what's been done in the name of, in some ways, just making more money and concentrating power, right? So, when you mentioned alchemy, but I'll talk about biology because I don't really know anything about alchemy, but I've got a body and I think that I'm making decisions in my brain. Like we all think that, right? But there are studies that show that your body moves slightly, but they did this study of people who were crossing the street And they found that the nerves told the foot to move before the brain decided that the light was green, like that there was something happening faster than the brain could do it. Our body is making a decision in some way that is like microseconds faster. And that makes sense, because if a tiger is running at you, you better not make a decision. Like, you better just run before your brain can process tiger. And so it makes sense that there's some of our body functions are working in ways that aren't explained by our brain made a decision. And that's pretty true of a lot of stuff. And people say, okay, why did you have that for lunch? And it's like, it goes all the way back to who grew it in what plantation on what farm. And what did I read about, whether your coffee should be processed this way or the other thing. And did I want to buy something that had less packaging and was more local? And, how much time did I have to be at the supermarket? And now I'm like, I think I'll decide what to have for lunch. Well, that's not when the decision got made. So when we're talking about the media environment, it's really important. So the simplest thing is like, okay, well, the media is like my nervous system, which is giving me sensations from here to there. And then I've got this brain making decisions or the body making decisions. And if something goes wrong over here, then, I would feel it maybe if I pricked myself, and then, it would locally, that would clot the blood. Right. And it would only become more of an emergency to make a decision about if that didn't work properly at the beginning. Right. And then maybe I'd put a Band-Aid on it. And if it was really a serious thing, I'd have to take my whole body to the emergency room. And so it's like there's these local decisions and then, more global decisions. But it's all based on getting the right information. So if you have a completely corrupt media environment, and this is what happens with patients with diabetes, that their nervous system, like their feet lose sensation, and then they can lose a toe because they don't feel it when they're, And so when we start to think about decision-making, you really have to go back to where is all the media coming from and how do you start creating a truth machine? And we talked about blockchain before. And so blockchain's being used for what I think is mostly, there's some other projects now, but the most uninteresting application is money. But what about information? What if we could start to validate information in a kind of ledger where we would know what? You can't know if information is true. You're an adult. I can tell you that there is no truth, right? You're okay with that. We haven't figured out the truth yet, but we can know who attested to it, right? So you could create now some kind of thing where we actually know who made that claim. Was it a person? Was it a thermometer? Those are two different claims. Was it if you took a test and the test said you had this particular antigen, okay, who produced that antigen test? What is the percentage that particular type of test is correct? When did you take it? Who administered it? How many minutes after you took it was it assessed? By which laboratory? All of that information could be stored in a way that we would be able to have much better data systems, and much better access to data. And then we could also understand, one of the things that's also a waste that we've done with social media, if you talk about democracy and social media, every day in some ways you're certainly participating in a something, right? You're tweeting or you're working Facebook or you're reading a particular type of news and you're reacting in some way. And you're either saying, I'm going to keep reading this author on Substack or I'm not. I consider them reliable or not. And all of those are signals about what you believe and what you're an expert in and, where your leanings are going. And so if you think about all that information about what I like and what I'm interested in and what I care about and what I'm following, it's a very good day-to-day indicator of something. And then once in 4 years, you take a survey and vote for somebody. That's crazy. We actually know the nuanced preferences of everybody about everything. And we're not using them as an input to our decision-making systems that would help us have a society that fits people better, just fits people better, right? And then, yeah.
In order to achieve that society that fits people better, what would you say are some of the first steps, basically, that we would implement? Because I personally, I would argue that, like, okay, maybe once every 4 years is probably the wrong thing. We do have local elections more often than that, and sometimes state elections and, you know, congressional elections, at least in the U.S., for the House of Representatives are once every 2 years. But would you say we should shorten the time frames? Would you say that we should go to more of sort of a direct democracy where it's like, if the bill affects over X amount of things, maybe the people should vote on it, no longer the representatives? I don't know. Again, like, what's, how do we achieve, how do we get closer to utopia, I guess is the word, or for that matter, like a more representative of human beings' democracy? And then just as I'm talking here, a follow-up question to that, once you've even answered that part, is, are we ready for that? Like, is the average person even ready for what you're about to say? So, you know, it's a reasonable, reasonable thoughts in my head anyway.
I mean, the first thing is you do have to recognize that democracy starts with your own level of awareness and your own agency. And the first step depends on who you are. Right. The first step can be something like, I'm not willing to expose my medical history when I walk into a restaurant. And I had that situation. I mean, I'm a Jew and I was in Germany doing a conference for somebody in Berlin leading a facilitation about DAOs. And it was during when the pandemic was still, there were still restrictions on people's movements and you had to get certain tests or have certain procedures done to you. And I went to a restaurant with my client and I told my client, look, I'm a Jew. I'm not going to show my green card at a restaurant. I'm not going to do that. You know, I had all the tests. Of course, I had all the tests. Because we knew at that time that the vaccine wasn't preventing transmission, and I'm going to lead a facilitation at your organization. I had, you know, both the PCR and the rapid test. I know I'm clean. I have the documentation. I'm not going to show it in order to get entry to a place. And he said, don't worry, it'll be fine. And then he took me to a place that checked me. And I said, you know, and I asked the guy, I said, well, you know, are you asking me because you're concerned about your safety or because you're doing what the government told you? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm just doing what the government told me. I have to do that. And I was like, well.
Given, not to be cynical here, but given the background, given the country, and given I'm just following orders, especially where they were saying that, there's definitely some, yeah, there's definitely some some stuff that needs to, especially given all of those circumstances, I'm just saying there's definitely some, some leftover remnants of things that we haven't done so great in the past with. So I can definitely understand where you're coming from there.
And my client didn't stand up for me. In fact, a few days later, he invited me to a restaurant with the entire team to conclude, you know, at the end of the facilitate 3 days. He's like, we're all going out for a team dinner. And he invited me to another place to make sure that I knew that, you know, if I was going to be in this situation, it wouldn't just be him and his wife. It would be the entire team that I have to be in that uncomfortable situation in front of. Like, this is how we do things here. And so, but I'm giving that as a, where do you start, right? You start by taking your own agency. And whether you think I should have just shown my green card or not, it doesn't matter. Whatever you believe you should do. And that's where people have to start getting ready, right? You're saying, are people ready? We're all ready to do something small, whether it's say no to our family or say no to something like that, you know, or say no to certain types of education of our children. You know, in the United States, there's these laws that are coming in to take away parents' authority over their own children. And it's horrifying. The state shouldn't have authority over my child, and a medical doctor shouldn't have authority over my child. Not, it's my child. And I think everyone should stand up for that. Again, whether you agree with the medical procedure or don't agree with it, you're the parent and the government doesn't, and your school telling you what, it's just, these are things where you need to take your own agency. And if you can't do it about your own child, yeah, you're not ready for democracy. I'm sorry to tell you, and you're not going to have it real soon.
Again, that's right. And that's the second part of the question, which is we might not be ready for this given the current state of affairs. But let's go to the other side and let's say that people start taking their agency and let's say that things start happening and people are waking up. How do we inch towards this more direct, I guess, direct democracy? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I'll just speak on behalf of everybody else. I don't want to go to the polls every day. I'm sure you don't either. That's just irritating. So we can't do an all the way. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows that. You can't go all the way to a direct democracy. It's just too much. But at the same time, it's like, but maybe there's a happy medium. Maybe I go once every 6 months. Or maybe it's like, you know what? Once a month, there's this thing. And there's, you know, there's three different things that you would vote on as a direct democracy because they met the following conditions. Or I don't know. I'm pulling this out of the air. But It seems like there could be scenarios where we do this and technology would be a strong boon for those.
Yeah. So the first thing is you have to start recognizing that where you're thinking from is what we've got and how do we progress from there. And that limits what you can think about. Like, oh, it's about voting and it's about decisions. And again, I told you, we don't make the decision at the moment we think to make the decision. And the other thing is about voting is a very rough mechanism. Voting, by definition, says the majority will impose its will on the minority. And that's the way it works. And that I'm not saying that there's always a choice, but what I'm saying is that whenever you vote, you're always putting people in a divisive position.
I suppose that's true for standard voting. But I've heard some interesting things about potentially stack ranking things, mm-hmm. which is really interesting because you never, number two or three could easily win in that scenario. So potential stack ranking. But again, that's the other problem is if you do stack ranking, then you can, again, once you get people who know probability reasonably well, it's like, right. But now you can game the system in a very different way other than being divisive. So I don't think there's a perfect solution that exists necessarily.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of things to say, right? Like, where do you start? Again, you start where you are and with what you're interested in. I think one of the really important places to start is with the media landscape and the information and ecology and also understanding people's interactions with that. Because if I could create a platform, this is one that somebody was telling me about that they were trying to develop, but they were... It was a professor, so she never really, like, it was all research and it was never something practical. But she actually did some experimentation with a kind of social media platform where you could, again, show attestations. Like, I saw this article that said that, you know, whatever, this, you know, this is happening, whatever, this drug safety is happening or this politician is corrupt. And then people would critique the source, not the person. They wouldn't say, I disagree with you. They'd say, hey, that source writer is the brother of the politician, or that source is actually paid for by the pharmaceutical company, or whatever. And so they would engage in these arguments. And she said it was really interesting to watch how, and they would bring other sources. And it would increase people's sense-making. And she said people who you wouldn't believe changed their minds because they weren't being attacked for their position. They were being enlightened. They were being told, hey, listen, that source is a problem. And here's an alternative. And so it is possible to, first of all, clean up our information ecology. Another example in the information ecology space I like to give is Slashdot, which is super geeky and a little old, right? Shows my age. But Slashdot was a news system. And what was great about it is every post, you would start with, I think, one karma point. And everybody would have a certain number. You'd have like from +5 to -5 karma points or +3 to -3. Everybody would have whatever karma they had earned by their behavior on the platform. Now, that's pretty good, right? And then if I've been a jerk on the platform and been and flamed people on the platform and been mean, my posts immediately are invisible to everybody based on my karma. Whereas if my karma is really good, my posts start to float to the top. Now that does two things. One is if I have good karma, I'm being heard more. But also if I have good karma, you could actually do today some sort of natural language processing and say, let's look for all the people who are experts on this topic, whatever it is, art history or something important, environmentalism, you know, water systems. We're trying to figure out whether to make a hydroelectric dam or not. Let's look for all the people who have the most positive karma on this topic using some search engine or natural language processing. And you could get a list. And the only people who can run for this position of chief of, you know, whatever it is, they have to fall into that top 100 people. Now, that's not a far stretch. That's technology we've got today. You can't run for office unless you're in the top whatever percentile of people who've been voted on every day, right? Every day by what comes out of whatever their keyboard, not their mouth. But every day you're actually adding to the vote towards somebody who you respect. And you don't have to remember what happened. What was the name of that person who said that smart thing? No, that's accumulated. And like I said, that's not a stretch. That much information definitely exists today. But you can't do it on Twitter, we'll see. But you can't do that on Facebook or Twitter because Facebook optimizes for the biggest assholes and the most controversial people. And Twitter has had very different censorship programs to get rid of a certain, you know, like now with Elon Musk, a lot of people have come back, but you've cut out people whose ideas you don't like. Now you can't do that if you want a democracy. So you might need new platforms, but it's not new technology. That's not new technology. It's just implementation. I do want to add one more piece about the moderation at Slashdot. Because like, how did you know somebody had good karma? Well, how it worked was everybody got a turn. If you had good karma, once a year, you got moderation points. So it was something like jury duty in some ways. So you didn't get to vote for good things and bad things all the time. You just had like 2 weeks a year. And then you had something like 8 different categories you could say. So if I read David's comments, I could write it as insightful, redundant, controversial, flame bait. There were a bunch of funny, you could have a good sense of humor, well-informed. So you could have that type of system. Again, it's quite old technology. That's not even new tech, right? That's, you know, whatever, 10, 15-year-old technology where everybody gets 2 weeks a year of points. And people would love it. Imagine Facebook let you be the moderator for, you know, one day a month. You'd be like, yay, it's the, you know, whatever, it's the 18th, it's my day to get my moderation points. You'd look forward to it because it's like getting more influence. You wouldn't ask to be paid for it. You wouldn't need any incentive. You'd just be like, this is the day I get to show them who the smart people are, who my favorite people are and whatever. And then you get moderation by the people. And you don't have to have some board of like experts who say this is false information and this is correct information. I mean, we all know there's no truth. You get human beings bringing the best content to the top. And then you can optimize instead of for people fighting about something, the most insightful content, which is really what Slashdot is doing or was doing, is the most insightful and interesting content and the funniest content would float up to the top automatically.
Which is fair. I would say that was a pretty captive audience though, and a very particular type of audience. If you think that this can work, if your conjecture is that this is able to work on sort of the general public, I would say you're a definite optimist, which is a good thing. I love optimism. I think it's awesome. But I'm not sure how well that would translate with everybody on every level. Although again, you made some interesting points because it's maybe like, well, you can't moderate everything. You're going to moderate the things that you're the most engaged on and that you're the most well-informed on, et cetera. So I don't know. These are interesting things. Are these, by the way, things that you're doing with Priceless DAO? Is this sort of the backbone for your organization there?
I wish if you knew somebody who wanted me to do that. But it's very hard to talk to social media developers. I mean, I've talked to a lot of them and I've tried to get them together. There's a whole bunch of different ones. And this is quite sophisticated stuff that takes a big budget. And, you know, I'm talking about AI and talking about, and also, like you said, it takes an audience of people who care. And you could do it. And I think that, so what we're doing at Priceless is really looking at smaller scale experiments. That's the first thing, right? I mean, in my whatever industry group, I know a lot of people who they've got the answer. They know how to do one world government. Like they know the answer for one world governance. And they've got a whole plan in their head, or they've got a whole plan on paper on how the world is going to be governed. And you're like, aha. Let's try this on a regional level. And that's really what Priceless is about. Priceless is looking at, so I talked about the nervous system, right? What's the circulatory system, right? What moves resources from one place to another in my body is the circulatory system, and that's money. And this is one of the reasons why we have, it doesn't matter whether you're in a capitalist system or a socialist system or a dictatorship or a democracy today. You know, money talks, something else walks. And that's because the circulatory system is all based on money. Now, there's reasons for that, and not every country necessarily wanted that, and it was imposed upon them. And you've got organizations like the IMF or like certain types of government agencies who are trying to extract. But right now, that's your circulatory system, and you don't shut it down. You don't shut down your circulatory system. It runs everything. And so, unfortunately, the circulatory system of human systems is killing off the circulatory system of all other life on the planet. So it's not going to go well if we keep up this way. And so what Priceless is looking at is what could be other monetary systems, other organizational systems, particularly on a regional level. So we're interested in bioregions. We're interested in a community-to-community things. I've been in talks with some people in Barcelona who are trying to take different hubs within the city and have them connect to one another in a non-monetary accounting system. Eco-villages also in north of Spain. And so we've got a number of different projects, which we don't know how to fund. I don't know how to get those things funded. Because they're not profitable, they're not exactly nonprofits either. They're an alternative that we believe in one or two generations would, you know, we would evolve into. And, you know, go try and explain to a funder that this is going to, you know, you're not going to get quarterly results. You're not necessarily going to save somebody from starvation today. But what you're working at is a new infrastructure that might replace today's democracies, but maybe you're not in your lifetime. Like, it's very difficult to get backing for that. I do want to give more of a concrete example because people are like, oh, that was all a lot of like blah, blah jargony. So I was talking to these eco-villages. I went around and just interviewed them. What do you do? And they said, well, with this other eco-village, we don't really keep accounts. You know, we give them logs and they give us their truck and we give them some bread and they give us some beer. And, you know, like we kind of have a thing and they send their kids to our kindergarten and we kind of have like a loose accounting system. We kind of know if we trust them. And when I went deeper into it, it was, first of all, we do that with them, but not with the other village, because that village over there, that's not an eco-village. They don't have a shared economy, right? So it's the eco-villages have a shared economy. It's all, they have 40 families and one bank account, fundamentally. And everybody eats together and everybody works together. And if you go and you work in the city, you put your money into that bank account. And that's tough, but people do it. So with the other eco-village that operates like us, we share. But that those guys aren't an eco-village. They each have, they're just a bunch of families who lived near each other and regenerated an old village. But they don't have the same ecological things as we do. And they don't have a shared bank account. So they can send their kids to our kindergarten. That's fine. But they pay. So there's actually a value tracking system that's built in. And then at some point, somebody told me, oh, yeah, we stopped that trade. And I was it was specifically about the logs in the truck. And I was like, what happened? And they said, I don't know, it was just like a feeling that, I don't know, something didn't feel right about it. And so there's this fairness, like, does it feel fair? Like, is the trade fair? Was like coming up in their heads. And so we started thinking, what would it be like to take 50 villages like that and have some kind of formal registration of all that? We're doing this, and it would look like your normal invoicing system. Did we use money? Did we not use money? Did they act professionally? Did they deliver on time? Were they ecological? Were they not ecological? But on a basis that each village, not each individual, gains reputation, which is very different, because you want to avoid that Black Mirror scenario where everybody's got a reputation on everybody else. And you want to create a situation where there's social cohesion, because I'm going to behave differently if I'm perceived as a part of something, right? If your company sends you to an appointment, you'll act on behalf of the company and you'll have certain behaviors. And if your mom says, you know, whatever, you go over and behave a different way with your mom's friend than with just somebody on the street, because your mom's reputation is tied up in there. So the idea that it's a group reputation is really important for holding these values. And so formalizing that exchange system was really, I think, is very interesting. And I noticed it when I was there, right? So, yeah.
So this, we have a mutual friend, Drea, mm-hmm. and I'm curious, have you spoken to her about some of this stuff? And again, for those listening, I have a whole podcast with Drea, et cetera. But basically, she has, this is one of the things that she's attempting to figure out in the Amazon with these groups of folks that are not really capitalist. They're not really, so they don't really conform to any, what we would call like a westernized form of collective. They're very similar to sort of what you were talking about, in the sense of like, well, how do we do these things like in the right way? And like, there's 40 of us, we all share one account, but we all have like different types of shares, but we're not actually that worried about the different types of shares as long as everybody's doing a reasonable amount of stuff. And again, with hers in particular, it's basically, it's like the Amazon rainforest and farmland and trying to protect that against various logging companies, narcos, et cetera, et cetera. And so it seems like this type of, you know, autonomous organization would work really well for things of this nature. And like, I mean, there's other ones as well. Like, for instance, there's like coffee cartels. I mean, cartel usually has a negative connotation, but there are actually cartels of folks that sort of do these collective bargaining agreements, to where they all almost, it's almost like a unionized type of deal where they unionize together and then collectively bargain with Starbucks or whoever else is buying up their coffee. I was exposed pretty heavily to that when I was living in Indonesia and whatnot. So there's lots of these different things. It seems like basically that these collectives are almost formalized, and then there's a specific set of rules put into place. And that's where the DAO really comes in. Is that what I'm hearing, or am I missing something in there?
Yeah. I mean, I love the work that Drea is doing. I'm on her advisory board, and you know, where we speak pretty frequently, and I'm helping her with some of her work there. And I think this is a perfect example of a few things. One is, we don't have to create the rules and social cohesion because they exist. In other words, you have a full system specification when you walk in, right? We know what the rules are of these tribes. They're very clear about them. They can describe them in detail. And now you have to go out and search for a technology that will implement them. So that these guys told her, nobody can own the land. Land can't be owned. All right. Well, so now they need a mechanism for ownership that is recognized by legal structures that we have for ownership, but doesn't really endow ownership. And that's where she used a DAO. It's a very unusual case, actually. It's very specific, but it's very useful. And there's a lot of tribes who live like that. And so if she and indigenous peoples who should co-own the land, and creating a legal entity that can't be exploited by the tribal leader, that can't be, it doesn't need passing on when the tribal leader passes on. Those are innovative solutions that we can do with today's DAO technology. And she's designed it in such a way that the funds are distributed, a certain percentage go, for example, some go to the people, but none of them go to the leader to distribute among the people. They go direct. And some of it goes to a children's education fund so the children can go to school. And that can't be tampered with. There's no corrupt official in the middle. It's a very clear thing. And so this is one of the things I say to people is like, first, get your system specifications. And you can hear the same thing with my work with the eco-villages, because I'm not trying to impose a technology on anybody. I'm not trying to impose a system of governance. It's saying, what do you do naturally? And we spent a couple of days just talking about, what do you mean by fairness? What do you mean by fairness? How do we put that in a digitized system so that we're like, these guys were fair with us and this trade felt fair? Because it's funny, right? If you're, let's say you're a mentor and you give people advice. Well, for me, fairness as a mentor would be they either took my advice or let me know why they didn't take it. And if they took it, they told me how it went. And that's a fair trade, you know. And it's an unfair trade if they keep asking you for an hour every week and ignore my advice. It's like the same hour. What the heck, right? So fairness is a funny concept, right? And so this is one of the things that I think we need to look more at, rather than incentivizing people, looking at what would you do normally? What are humans doing? And then using, and the technology is very, like I said, the technology, we have technology today that we didn't have when we invented these forms of democracy. And we need to start looking at local scales and at biodiversity, again, cultural diversity. Everyone loves cultural diversity. You know, you want French food and German cars, but not the other way around. I mean, that's just how it is.
Fair. I want to break away from this for a half sec because I do want to come back, but I want to talk about the sort of the negative side of this blockchain stuff, which I tend to agree with you. I'm on the same, I guess, the critic side, which is this cryptocurrency stuff seems to be effectively nonsense, and artificial type of stuff. What have you seen with some of the blockchain stuff that you've been working on with some of the ICOs, et cetera? Like, is there, outside of like illicit payments, again, this is crypto, not blockchain, so we're separating the two here. But with a cryptocurrency, like outside of illicit payments, and then I don't really know. I mean, basically, you're eating up a tremendously huge amount of power to try and generate these things. And then on top of that, there have been hacks. We use the word hack, but it's effectively a bank robbery that are larger than any bank robberies that have ever existed in history. I think the largest bank heist in the United States was something like $20 million from like an armored car at one point in time. And that's on the small end of the crypto heists. I mean, the crypto heists have literally lost billions and billions from these various exchanges and, you know, all these other types of things that have occurred where it's like, yeah, I mean, they got away with $400 million. It's like, that's not even that, that's like a mid-sized one. That's not even like that's not even the craziest one. So I'm curious from your perspective, and from a different person's perspective, obviously I'm pretty biased against them, but what does that look like from your end? Do you have any insights there?
I do. I have insights and opinions. I don't even agree with myself on these things. So first of all, bank heists and money and whatever. Okay, like, let's just, the money is completely imaginary, right? And crypto has created this magic money invention machine. So those heists of magical money, it's ridiculous. I look at my wallet sometimes. I had to buy a car recently. And I looked at my wallet and I'm like, oh, I've got a couple hundred airdrop from this thing and an airdrop from that. I don't know how I got that money in there. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And then, you know, sometimes it disappears and I'm like, it disappeared. All right, well, whatever. And I reported on my taxes, you know, or one of the things showed, there was this interesting thing showing that crypto donors donate more money than other you know, like than the average donor. Like the average donor in the United States gives a certain amount in crypto, because it's like, I've got this magic money. I either have to report all my taxes or like, you know what? I'm just going to give it to this charity. Like it never happened. Never happened. It's so much easier. And it's true. I do. I give charity from those places where I'm like, oh, I got an airdrop again. What am I going to do? All right, I'm going to give it to charity. Because otherwise it's too complicated to even explain. So are the heists good? No, it's really bad. And is all of this monetary inflation good? No, it's a disaster. But it's not a huge disaster. I mean, somebody was explaining Dogecoin to me once, and it really spoke to me. And he said, look, why is Dogecoin out there? It's because all these young people today, like, honestly, what can you tell them? Your system is in collapse. You're never going to be able to pay off your student loans. Your mortgage rates are going up. You're never going to be able to afford a house. You're going to have to move out to the boonies and work remote. Like, you have nothing. And you're like, you know what? Dogecoin. Maybe I can use this magic money machine to somehow make enough money. And I have friends who, like, that's how they've made. I have a friend who's an actor who, you know, for the last 2 years has been making more money than he ever made, you know, paying his rent on these ridiculous coins. Is that bad? Is that good? I don't know. You know, it's crazy. It makes no sense. But the entire monetary system is about to collapse. So that's the first thing, is like, I have a real hard time judging any of it, because we've created a world in which our young people have no hope to do things the way that we did. And even, you know, like I look at my mom and, you know, how much she saved for her retirement versus how much I saved. And it's just, you know, it's, I'm struggling, and there's no reason for me to be struggling. It's ridiculous. I've worked hard my whole life. So that's one aspect. The other one I wanted to touch on is, you said illicit. And like, there's a question about what it means to be illicit at this point. Like I said, you're not allowed to withdraw in Europe more than $1,000 of your own cash that you earned. Like, I went, and if I earned 3,000 euros this month, I can't go to the bank and ask for that all at once. I have to go one day, the next day, the third day, and probably somebody's going to ask questions and track me about it. And I earned that money. And it's illicit for me to try and get out more than that. And it's illicit for me to take that 3,000 euros that I just withdrew and give it to my child or my contractor or my whatever. That's illicit use of money. So we need to be really careful when we start saying illicit, as our government is cracking down on us. And we now have the IMF announcing central bank digital currencies, which I don't know if people are aware of what that means, but until now, the companies have been able to track all of your credit card, everything you do is tracked. That's nice. Like, that's really upsetting. And they know whether you like ladies' underwear. I'm not saying you do, David, but they know because it's on your credit card. or whatever it is, right? They know how many pacifiers I bought for my children and how many water bottles I lost at the gym. And, you know, they know. Not saying that I lost any water bottles at the gym. Anyway, so, but central bank digital currency is really different. Central bank digital currency is, we control what you can do with it. And so guess what? If we decide that everybody's got to be vegetarian, not that that's been announced, or vegan, when you go to try and buy some beef, it's like, oh, sorry, your allocation is over. And you can't buy that with the money that is in your wallet because it's a central bank digital currency. So as we look at a world that our leaders are speaking quite openly about central bank digital currencies and quite openly about the fear that we might all be terrorists, and the fear that, well, there's not going to be enough petrol to get around, and you should cut down on your use of da-da-da-da, and you shouldn't fly everywhere. We should be very concerned about what might become illicit all of a sudden and how much of our freedom is really a threat. And if you look at what happened, I don't know, in Canada with the truckers protests, these people who are having peaceful protests against their government, which is a free government, right, in a free country, had their bank accounts frozen. Not only that, but the coffee shops that they sold them some breakfast had their bank accounts frozen. And that Bitcoin was used in that case. And you know, you may live in a free country and I may live in a free country, but for somebody who doesn't live in a free country, or if your country suddenly becomes less free, you may be very interested in illicit transactions. Illicit.
That's very, because again, exactly what you said, it depends on what we're talking about as far as illicit. There's two responses that I have to that. So the Dogecoin is actually pretty funny because Dogecoin was literally created as a joke coin to make fun of cryptocurrency, and then all of a sudden it wasn't. So I think that's sort of an amusing anecdote. The secondary thing that I would say is, and again, when we talk about these central bank digital currencies, and I'm honestly asking, I'm not really sure what we're talking about. And the reason I say that is the US has been a digital currency since the 70s. When Nixon took us off the gold standard, it's not backed by gold, and we do not print cash to be able to cover all the USD that exists out there. So it's been tracked by computers literally forever. Well, okay, not forever, but like, you know, for the past 40, 50 years. So when we start saying that we're going to do a US digital currency, my question is, what, we're already a digital currency. So what are we really talking about when we say, oh yeah, we're going to do, well, like they're going to do like the US coin. It's like, but we already have the US coin. I don't understand what we're saying now. Is it just, we're going to implement blockchain? And I'm like, but blockchain is just a, again, for those of us who aren't technical, blockchain is just not, it's just a database that's backed by crypto that's decentralized. It's not, again, it's sort of irrelevant. Not to mention, you can have private blockchains. So if the US government runs its own blockchain, it's like, yeah, but they can't change it. It's like, yeah, they can, because they can basically stop, they can stop the transaction from going through. I mean, there's, if you control the blockchain end to end, it isn't infallible. That's sort of the point of the decentralized blockchain, which is like, no, you don't control it end to end. That's sort of the, so hacking it, it's happened, but hacking it is really hard, or at least it's way harder. So can you speak to that? Like, how does that look as far as, I thought we were already a digital currency.
Right. So that's perfect. And that's why people think it sounds like nothing. Doesn't it sound like nothing? But here's the thing, right? If you use dollars, most of the money is not printed by the Fed. Less than 5%, that's called the inflation rate, is printed by the Fed. Anything the Fed prints is the inflation rate, basically. They're printing more money than there was in circulation. And that's tense. It's a little bit, it's a lot more lately. They're not telling you exactly how much it is, but, you know, 5%, 9%, whatever it is. Where's the rest coming from? It's coming from banks. And banks put it into existence by loaning it to you when you take a mortgage or you get a loan, a personal loan or a loan on your business. So when I use money, I'm using a credit card, which is a company. I'm charging on that credit card, which, and then I'm paying the credit card back from my bank, which has gotten the money from somebody they loaned it to, which they have permission to do by the federal government. So what does the federal government know about what I did? Nothing. And what does my bank know? It's not really clear, right? The credit card company knows and they sell it to, you know, whatever, Experian or something. But who knows what about me, right? Now, a lot of these banks are insolvent and we saw some weird stuff going on and we'll probably see a lot of it. But they're basically insolvent because they've got, if everybody went to get their cash out of the bank, it wouldn't be there, right? So, and then in this last bailout, we saw the Fed say, we're going to cover everybody in Silicon Valley Bank, one-to-one, right? One-to-one. And they printed a few billion dollars to do it. And what if they didn't have to print it? They just put it onto your central bank digital currency. And what if the Fed just said, you know what? This, every bank that goes under, we're just going to look at your accounts there and we're going to give you a central bank digital currency on your wallet. It's going to be in your little app in your phone that the government controls, the app in your phone. And you don't need a bank anymore. Don't worry. Now who has all the information? Oh, you don't like that? You said it's no big deal. We've been on digital currency forever, David. What are you worried about?
That's a really good point. So it's a good point for multiple different reasons, because a lot of people don't understand the buying process, but you do. So the point of sale system, meaning where you swipe your card, that actually knows what you bought, but Visa doesn't. Mm-hmm. Visa is just, it's $60 at Walmart or whatever. And then, and so on and so forth. So like when you, yeah, okay, now I'm on the same page. Cause when you tap that app, it's like, that was the point of sale and it's got to report it back to the government. I mean, they literally now know end-to-end transaction. Whereas like, yeah, it's like, you know, there's, everybody has a different slice of things, like the point of sale system versus the actual, the issuing bank versus Visa or the issuing network, et cetera. Everybody's got a slice of it, but it's hard to put together. Not impossible, but like difficult. But now you're talking about, no, I know exactly how many pairs of ladies' underwear David just bought at Walmart or whatever it is.
I hope you have better taste than that if you're going to wear ladies' underwear, my friend.
You never know. You never know. But yeah, I mean, holy smokes. Okay, now I'm getting it. So basically, we're cutting out a whole bunch of things that would go straight to the government, in which case they basically have effectively perfect information on the purchasing habits of people.
Well, that's the start, right? The next step is, let's say we don't have a trade agreement with China and you want to buy something on Alibaba, right? You want some Cuban cigars? You can't, because as soon as you tap that thing, okay, now that's just about import and export. And there was actually one of the guys at one of the central IMF thing, when one of these guys actually let that slip. We don't like what you did. What if it's because it's programmable money now? This is programmable money. It's not traceable in retrospect. It's programmable. And so it could program in what you can see and what you can't see and what you can buy and what you can't buy. And then what happens if we decide to ration gasoline? Because that might happen. You don't like that? You're making a face.
I mean, we did that in the 70s, right? I mean, we did that literally with gas lines, but now it's like, yeah, there's no back doors, there's no nothing. Like the phone is just rejecting you and be like, no, you had your ration. Screw you. Yikes.
So you getting Bitcoin this week?
Maybe. You're raising some really interesting points here. Now, of course, the other side of this is, how do we combat this as humanity? How do we fight against this? Like, what's the solution, or for that matter, a solution?
Well, don't worry, I've got all the answers. I'm about to tell you.
Send it. I'm excited.
You know, like I said, it starts from not being willing to show your green card at a restaurant, all the way up to developing alternative systems to homesteading. Everybody's going to find where their place is. You know, right now we're seeing people speaking out against things that were politically incorrect last week, whether that's, that I won't go into it, but, you know, like there's a lot of information coming out these days by people who are willing to be whistleblowers at the cost to their reputations and their professional lives, and are willing to tell the truth. And that may be you, whoever's listening. Or like I said, it may be you saying, look, I'm not going to comply with what people tell me, you know, the government taking away my power over my own children. I had a friend who he has two children, and he was in the UK, and they had a sex education system over there. And his first child came out of the sex education, I don't know, it was like 10 or 11 or something, like blinking, like just for 3 days, like with this, couldn't stop blinking. And then he went and investigated what that was. And because he's a white guy, native to Britain, he went and he spoke to them about it and made sure that that didn't happen to his second son. He said, what about these Muslim women? You know, their kids are being shown stuff that is, you know, they've got to show them they got to show them the actual acts. Like, you don't have to show that to educate a child about sex. They'll figure it, like, give them the basics, you know. And, you know, obviously the Muslim women there didn't like it, but they couldn't speak up because they were immigrants and people are going to say something and it's not, you know. And so he felt really strongly that he, as a white British guy, had to go in there and have a talking to the school. We all have to start with wherever it starts for us. And that could be writing to your congressman, and that could be creating alternative systems, and that could be buying a Bitcoin, and telling the U.S. government that, and voting for candidates who feel that freedom is important, freedom of the press. And, you know, for everybody, it's different. I do think we are going into a period of time, or we're already there, where there are alternative economies happening. There are alternative people, and whether that's just a few people living on a homestead and sharing with their neighbors, because if you share, it's not a taxable income, all the way through the whole crypto bro people. I know people who for 5 years have not used fiat currency.
Really? How do you buy groceries with Bitcoin or whatever? Is that a real seriously, I'm honestly asking, is that a thing? Or are there like, oh, maybe there's, I think there's maybe credit cards that allow you to swipe and then do the transaction. Like it's swiping with fiat, and then they kind of do the transaction on the back end to where it takes away from whatever Bitcoin you have or whatever, something like that, right?
Yeah. They're debit cards that you can top up with your, and there's certain establishments. I mean, I know which establishments they are. In my country, it's pretty common, and you'll see a little thing. We take Bitcoin, and you can tap and pay with Bitcoin. So maybe you have to do certain establishments. I get, I get a grocery thing from my co-op, and I haven't asked them. But, you know, if I asked the local co-op if they take Bitcoin, they probably would. You can just, you know, maybe it limits to some degree what you can do. The hardest thing used to be flights, but now there's websites where you can get flights. You have to show your passport at the border, but
you might be changing my mind on a couple of things here. I got to be honest with you. I now see some interesting things about where we're going. Well, but if you just look at it from like the engineer perspective, I'm like, what's so great about this? It's a way slower database that's backed by crypto. This is not hard stuff. Like, I can solve all these problems, but now that you're sort of bringing in some of the civil disobedience, political aspects, et cetera, I'm going, okay, this is, it's not just here's a goofball math problem that you bought for real money. It's like, oh, okay, this is a way to potentially push back against certain things as human beings. All right. I'm on board. There's some interesting stuff here.
There's also the truth machine aspect, right? So we were talking about Drea and what she's doing with DAOs, and she's not doing this, but some other ecological projects are doing things like attestations about the ecological system. So like I said, you could have a blockchain, and again, it's a big, slow database, but it can't be altered. And it's like, this person had this water test of the water downstream from the factory at this date, and here's the data. And then the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and that's not, and this tree is standing, and here's a photograph of it. And so we know whether forest restoration is happening. And so having a truth machine of some sort, and I'm not sure that blockchain is the right structure, right? I mean, I'm very interested in some of the hashgraph technology and the holochain technology that's using different types of ledger systems, because one big database of everything in one place is clearly never going to be scalable. But there's ways to have different types of truth machines that can't be tampered with, that has a lot of applications. And as I was talking about before, what is the truth of the, you know, how can we know if something's a deep fake or not a deep fake? I think there are going to be applications of this type of technology so that you know the provenance of something.
I mean, I would argue right now, one of the best startups to start is not an AI startup. It's an anti-AI startup, as in be able to detect anything generated by AI on the fly. I would argue you can get money for that startup way easier than you can for a pure AI startup. Truth be told, I don't think that'll ever go away. There's something about, I don't even know where to dive into our psychology. It's either our egos or our belief that we're special or any of these types of things, but there's something about human generated things, especially now that AI can do a tremendous amount of stuff. And you and I have probably known about this stuff for a long time, but like it's sort of gotten into the real mainstream where, you know, even completely non-technical folks are talking about this type of stuff. But there's definitely something too, like, can you authenticate that this is real and that it's not generated by AI and that this is an actual human doing this or that or the other, something of this nature? I would argue that's probably going to be one of the most popular things to start in the coming future, is just AI detection among other things. That said, you know, on the other hand, there's all sorts of amazing stuff coming, like AI and medicine and various things. Like, yeah, also help us get smarter too. Like, I don't care if it's a human being or AI that saves my life. Like, whichever one does it better, let's do that one, right? So there's definitely some give and take there. But there are some pretty strong oddities in our current economic system, are there not? I mean, I know that you've got some reasonably strong feelings on sort of some what some people would term unnatural accumulation of things. What does this look like?
Well, accumulation, it's not that accumulation is totally unnatural, but usually when things accumulate in natural systems, we call that cancer or overpopulation or something like that, right? And it kills off the other things in the environment. So you can't really, natural systems don't accumulate or store things for very long periods of time. Money is a complete anomaly in terms of the ability to always accumulate more of it and for it to continue to accumulate and be worth the same, not the same, but still be worth money over generations and generations and generations. This is a very unusual property of money. And because of this unusual property, our natural systems, like our humanity brain systems, are not very good with it. It's not where people have stored value in the past. The way people stored value in the past was with other people. So you didn't have a retirement fund. You lived in a community where your kids took care of you when you got old, or your community took care of your kids if you got knocked off. And so most of our store of value for long term was with other people within our communities. It was not in this accumulation of money. It was in our cultures and our religions and, you know, these types of canonical things, like behavioral things. And so for a relatively short time in human history, we've had these capital accumulation systems. We've had interest at the rates that we've got it now. We've had these systems that are in place for generations and not that many generations, but it hasn't worked out well for people. It, as a means of distributing resources, it has not created the optimal distribution, let's say, of just food and healthcare to humanity, right? Just keeping people alive. Like, you would think an economic system, the first thing it would be designed for is taking care of human beings. And it's very hard to argue that our current system optimizes for that. It certainly doesn't. And then our current system of monetary accumulation is also at the expense of our environment. Most of our stuff is extractive and it's mostly of energy, right? And so we've got all this money and it doesn't really represent anything in the real world. Like, if all the billionaires of the world released their money and was like, we're going to use that money instead of hoard it, we wouldn't have enough stuff to, like, we just wouldn't have enough stuff. So it's almost a false accounting system at this point. It's not meaningful, right? And at some point, currencies go bust. So it's kind of weird to think that you took down all of the forests and you fracked the mountains flat in order to put little numbers on a computer that they'll never be anything other, like literally nothing. You turned all of that into literally nothing. It's quite horrifying.
So is there, I mean, you were speaking about humanity in general there, but are there places that do this better or for that matter worse than others? Because I mean, each country has its own laws, and there are some countries that have different economic systems, et cetera. Are there examples of places that do this, you know, better versus worse, et cetera?
Most of them have been wiped out. I mean, most of them, you know, if they had any natural resources that any of the Western countries wanted, it's like we'd send you the East India country, or we'd send you a CIA agent, or we'd, you know, make sure that you complied. I mean, I live in the former Yugoslav Republic, which had I mean, people loved Tito. I was so surprised, right? Because I was growing up in America and that Yugoslavia was this like evil communist state and everybody was poor, which is true. People were poor, what's considered poor. But people were pretty happy. You talk to people. I mean, again, you know, there were bad problems and people knew that they were being censored. But people they loved that leader. They thought the Yugoslavian times were pretty good and people had jobs and they had felt meaningful about their work. And so that has been a system, and that's a modern system. You know, that's not necessarily an indigenous system. But that was destroyed by, you know, it imploded internally in some ways, but also it was certainly egged on by the outside systems. And there certainly are stories of, there's that book, I think it was like the biography of a economic hitman. I can't remember the exact thing where he talks about it was his job to go around and tell any economies that did not want to give up their natural resources that they were going to do it the easy way or the hard way. And so a lot of these societies have been knocked out. I was in Uganda. It was really interesting. And I was driving around with somebody who was, I don't remember what it was, who was part of the group I was with. And he was talking about this tribe up north, I think he said, where they don't wear clothes, and the government and the missionaries keep going in there and telling them that they need to wear clothes, and they're like, "Why do we need to wear clothes? Why do we need to wear clothes?" They've got a system going over there that doesn't use money, that they're pretty happy, and we would consider them poor because they don't even have clothes. But I mean, that's part of the way our system sees it, right? If you're a sustenance farmer, you're poor.
I suppose that's true. I mean, basically, we've come a tremendously long way, but it's like, right, we've come a tremendously long way from being living that same life like indigenous people. Some indigenous peoples do, and for that matter, sustenance farmers. But at the same time, it's like, right, but we've also injected a lot of nonsense that doesn't need to exist. Like there's no clothes don't make us human. Like if we shedded all the clothes tomorrow, we're still human beings. We may act a little bit different, but regardless, like it's you're still notably human, and you're not acting so much different that it's just like, oh, that's weird. It's like, no, mostly just shame goes away. So I think there's definitely something to that. And again, when you, it's actually one of the things that I admire the most about a lot of the indigenous tribes. I met a few of them again when I was living in Indonesia. Their level of happiness is quite high. They know what iPhones are. They know what the internet is. Like they're not completely uneducated people, and yet at the same time they're just like, I just don't really have any need for that. Like when I want something sweet, you know, I know how to go get the bees from the beehive, and we know how to use this smoking stick to calm them down, and we don't take the entire beehive. The bees are our brothers. So we get very specific in, you know, things of this nature, right? Like they don't go and take every last mango on the tree. They're like, no, some of them need to ripen. And then some of them we're going to make sure we save the seeds so we plant more. And so they end up in these, again, what we would consider to be extraordinarily like the absolute depths of poverty, because they own nothing. They have nothing. They live in huts and they, you know, have to slaughter things that they capture or hunt, or for that matter, farm. And it's like, right, but their happiness level, I mean, they've done 100 studies on this. Their happiness level is very high. And they function at a very interesting rate from the way the rest of us do. It seems like we inject all these things in modern society that is supposed to make us happier, and that oftentimes, again, I can't remember the first person to say this, but it's true. The things you own end up owning you, type of deal. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, like a lot of truth to that.
Well, we say we've made progress, but, you know, that's a bit of a religious belief because it depends on what you measure. Right? If you measure like the amount of minutes that you're actually touching another human being, we're in absolute poverty. And if you measure the amount of time that children get to spend with their grandparents, and if you measure the biodiversity on Earth, I mean, just simply biodiversity, right? Like, we are not making progress. we're making progress according to selective measures, which makes it look more like a religion than and an ideology than progress. And like you said, what makes you happy? It's like, I got enough food, I got shelter, I got my people around me. Living in a community where I think my kids are going to be taken care of, it, you know, maybe it's a dangerous community because I could starve to death or get eaten by a tiger or, you know, whatever. But my community is going to take care of my kids if I get eaten by that tiger. Gives me a lot of security, gives me, you know, my feeling. And we've lost sort of the meaning of life too, right? Our lives don't have meaning because religion isn't true anymore. And I've been fortunate to be religious my whole life and to believe in the religion I was born into and to have that faith in God. And I think that's really unusual these days, but it is definitely helpful. It makes me a happier person. And okay, maybe it's stupid to believe in God, but it definitely makes me happier.
It's funny. I was having this conversation the other day, basically telling my buddy, like, I think religion is the new politics is the new religion. I was like, the only difference is we're going backwards. And he's like, how do you figure we're going backwards? One of them's superstition. I was like, let's just say for sake of argument that it is superstition. Even if it is, people get something out of it. It makes them happier. It makes gives them a very specific moral code. Like, people get a lot out of it. You can't say the same thing about politics, which is why I say, again, politics is the new religion, and I would argue we're going backwards. So even though a lot of those people, like, you know, a lot of them that they're like, it's not my religion. I'm like, yeah, it is. There's certain things you can't talk about because of your political beliefs. There's certain people that are never wrong and always have the truth, because I was like, we can go on and on, but like, you have sacred things, you've got untouchables, like, you've got everything that all the other religions have, but you just basically boiled it down into politics. And the only difference between the two is many, many, many religious people get a tremendous amount out of their faith. Whether or not you think that's BS or not, it doesn't matter. For them, it's not. They get a tremendous amount out. Whereas what you get is you get your daily dose of drama and being outraged from your political religion. So again, you're going backwards. One man's opinion, and I know it's controversial, I'm just saying, it doesn't seem like people really get what they should be getting out of their, what I would term as their religion, which is a lot of their political beliefs. Yeah.
This is what's called mimetic tribes, right? And maybe it's exactly politics, or maybe you belong to the, you know, whatever LGBTQ plus group, and that's your mimetic tribe, and you hold the beliefs they hold, and you hold the flag they hold, and you have a sense of belonging, and you know who your people are. And in my case, it's sort of the regen refi plate people, and you know, I hang out with them, and I know what conferences I'm supposed to go to and what beliefs in my space, you're allowed to hold different beliefs about certain things, but you're not allowed to hold different beliefs about other things. And, you know, and you feel like you're belonging. I feel like in many ways, the crypto space has allowed me to have more radical beliefs and not fall into a category. But within crypto, I actually wrote something called crypto anthropology, something like a couple years ago. I mean, it was very tongue in cheek. Was talking about like the difference between Bitcoiners and Ethereans, and you know, it was, yeah, again, humorous, but I was like, well,
it's like different shades of Christianity or something. Like, yeah, we all believe in the decentralized currency, but I'm an Ethereum guy, you're a Bitcoin guy, we've got some common ground, but there's definitely some gaps between us, etc.
Oh, it's, if only we're that amicable. I mean, the Bitcoin maxis, like, there's a real fight between the Bitcoiners and them. It's more like, you know, whatever. It's more like the Protestantism and Catholicism. Some way. Like, Jesus is a thing, but we hate you. And so that going on. But yeah, I mean, these mimetic tribes are important because people need something to believe in. They need to have faith. They need to have belonging. And people don't do well in a world where we tell them that, oh, everything is relative. It's not, by the way. And, you know, moral relativism is horrible. It's horrifying. It's not everything is relative. It's not that way. But people fall into these tribes. And I think that, you know, I agree with, I think Brett Weinstein said, like, the difference between a cult and a religion is that a cult is new and hasn't proven itself for 1,000 years. And so it's going to give you some random things to do that don't make sense. If a religion's been around for 1,000 years, the rituals might look weird, but they have some sense to them because they've been around for 1,000 years. I mean, also my religion helps me with the work that I do, oddly enough, because we touched a little bit. We just mentioned DAO, which is like a decentralized autonomous organization. And we touched a little bit on databases as well. Like blockchain is the centralized, like all data, like the truth machine and whatever. But my religion is a decentralized religion. So we don't have a pope. Yeah. There isn't one pope. And we're not distributed like Protestantism. There's different branches of it. We're decentralized. And so each rabbi has his ability to interpret the scriptures. So we have a protocol, right? 613 laws written in our 5 books of Moses, and then the commentary on those. And based on that, each division of it is got its own protocol. And then we all know what the standard things are to do. And so if you go to a synagogue, you know what to behave. And if it's this holiday, you know what to do. And so we have a standard protocol, but we have all these forks or whatever you want to call it. And it's been really helpful for me to think about resilient democracy, distributed systems, distributed databases. Like the knowledge of Judaism is held in different places. And what would a distributed database really look like? And how do you maintain that over 5,000 years in this case? So actually, in this particular case, it's kind of interesting that it relates directly to my profession and how I think about how I think about distributed systems and how I think about what would governance look like if we wanted distributed governance? Like what, you know, there's something like a minimum viable thing to hold it together, right? Like, you know, my body is sort of this distributed system layered on top of, you know, like I've got a circulatory system and a nervous system and, you know, and a reproductive system and a digestive system. They're layered on top of each other in this kind of way. And maybe my brain is running all that, but there's a lot of evidence now that this, and so like thinking about these different examples of distributed governance are really helpful for trying to design these new systems.
For sure. It's an interesting thing you put into place, but again, you end up in this spot where it's like, but what are the truths that we are going to agree on? Because like you said, I mean, in Judaism, there's the 613 laws, but it's like, okay, but what, maybe we don't need that many. But again, you know, after 5,000 years, you're going to have more than a few. But regardless, as we move forward again with whatever society, whatever form society takes in the future, it's like, yeah, what can we agree on? Like what are these base level things? Do you have some input there?
I think really the only thing we can agree on is that aliveness is good. You know, like life is sacred. You know, we touched on AI. Life is sacred. And if you get that, then you're alive. And an AI could say that, but it wouldn't feel it. Like your cat feels that more than an AI feels that.
Way more.
Right.
But in that particular sense, you're saying life is sacred. And again, doesn't this get back to relativism? Because a tree is alive. And so are we, you know, do we no longer build houses out of wood? Can we never cut down anything? And is it okay to kill a tree as long as we plant another one? And, you know, obviously this is a ridiculous comparison, but like, could you do the same thing with humans? Like, yeah, I'll just get rid of this human as long as I make sure that we breed another one type of deal. And I'm saying like, there's this, I agree, it's a ridiculous comparison, but like you end up in this relativism space where it's like, we can all agree that life is sacred, but what is life? And where does that come from? I'm not going to get into that abortion nonsense because I don't even want to talk about that.
No, I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. But like, basically I'm just saying like when something is out there and in the world and alive, you know, we end up in the spot of like, well, what does that mean? Does it have to be sentient? And what does sentient mean? Like, is my dog sentient? Probably. Is a worm? I don't know. Maybe.
Well, I think that, again, this is a very modern Western thing that you're saying without, like, it seems obvious to you, for example, that you and I are individuals and that we're separate and that we're separate from the trees, but it's not obvious because if you eat an apple, before you eat the apple, there's an apple. And after you eat the apple is you. And so
correct.
If we think of the earth as an organism, it's a living organism with balances and checks and balances in the same way. Like you could say, well, actually each of my cells is an individual, right? Like if you think about it that way, then, you know, there's a right relationship. And individualism is a very, individualism is problematic. It's not true. It's not untrue either. But when we start to think about ourselves rather than as individuals, but in relationship with one another and in relationship with nature and in relationship with the tree, you know, I have a wood stove and I like it because I can feel how much, you know, of the natural resources I'm using to keep myself warm, and I keep my temperature in my house colder than I used to. And because I have a relationship, and I think that we've really disintermediated so many things. And, you know, when you don't disintermediate, you know, you grow chicken and then that's what you have, a chicken for dinner. And that's the chicken that was in your backyard. And you have a kind of an agreement with that and a feeling for the sacredness of life when you slaughter your own chicken. And there's never a simple answer, but the simple answer is we're all part of that. And our own human sustainability is dependent on the sustainability of the earth. It's not like a feel-good thing, like we've got to save the Amazon so that we'll be doing the right thing. It's like, well, I like air.
So does pretty much else that's alive on the planet. So yeah, I think there's at least one thing we can agree on. Air is good. Most things breathe. Almost everything breathes. I mean, even in the ocean, I mean, that they needs a specific amount of oxygen that you know the fish can literally pull out of there with the gills. So everything's somewhat oxygen based. All right. Well, in this particular vein, right? Like, what? How do we move forward? I mean, seriously, I'm honestly asking your opinion. You were saying like, there's going to be some distributed things and everybody takes responsibility and so on and so forth. But I'm going, is there a way to do this with technology, without technology? Do we all need to adopt a specific attitude? I mean, like how do we no longer go down this space where basically we're effectively using exploitation for almost everything?
I think we need to start, I mean, again, with different things in different places, right? I'm starting with regional economies and bio, and you can, then that's one way of doing it. Okay, what would regional economics look like? Bioregional restoration, I think, is really important. Starting to look at your own bioregion, and what does a bioregion mean? You know, it's maybe like your watershed and all the nature around it, and get together with people who are local to you. I think that a lot of these things only make sense in place with the people who are around you who are interested in that, and get to know, where's my food coming from? Could we shorten those supply chains? Could we create better agreements with our local farmers? And, you know, the current situation where it costs you twice as much to eat local rather than buy this, you know, food that's not local, it's really problematic. But start to form those alliances. I think for everybody, that's the basic thing. Start to understand, where's my food coming from? Where's my electricity coming from? How much am I using? How do I create community where I am? What are the issues that are important to me? And how do I find people local to me? And when you talk about agreement, it's really important not to agree, right? Like people who care about my school system, but we don't all agree with each other. Gray said some things about sex education that I don't agree with. Now, let's not yell at each other and start censoring books. Let's sit down in a circle. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about what we say at home to our children. Let's get to know each other humanly. And I think that's how it starts. We've completely forgotten how to touch other human beings, how to look our neighbors in the eye, you know, like good fences make good neighbors. No, they don't. And I think
he was being ironic when he wrote that, but still, I think people take that saying usually the wrong way. And you're right. He was literally saying they don't make good neighbors, as a matter of fact. But yeah, you're absolutely right. All right, last question. If there was a technology that you could blink into existence tomorrow, like you can, again, this is magic wand style, so you don't have to do any maintenance or any of that stuff. What would that technology be, and why would you put it into place? Obviously, something to do with what we've been talking about. What would that tech look like?
That is not the obvious answer, because I've been thinking, I knew you were going to answer this. And I am, like, to me, it's all about poop. I would like better technology to use our waste. Like, we use so much water, and then we have to recycle instead of putting that back in the ground. And also, in particular for my cats, like this litter box thing. Like, if I could invent something that would properly dispose of that and put it back in the earth in a safe place where it becomes compost the way that it should, that would, like, blink of an eye. It's crazy to be using fresh drinkable water this way. Crazy.
That is an excellent point. I actually have never thought of that. That's seriously, that's one of the most unique answers I've ever heard. I've never thought about that, but no, it's true. We're literally flushing drinkable water, which is crazy. Even with the low flow toilets and everything, it's just like, yeah, that's a tremendous waste. And then it goes into a processing plant, and then it doesn't actually feed back into the earth like it's naturally supposed to, with all the stuff that you would need to, like, plant other things, etc.
Yeah, it's insane. It's an insane waste.
Interesting. It seems like we could invent that. Like, there should be capture systems in various places.
The eco-villages frequently have compostable toilets, right? And it's not as lovely as what we're using. But once you've been to an eco-village and you've used a compostable toilet for a week, you kind of never want to go back. Like, it just breaks my heart. And the cat litter thing is really, you know.
Sure.
The one inconvenience of having cats and, you know, whatever, diapers for kids. Like, there's so many things that are in the poop industry that could be done so much more ecologically and intelligently.
I mean, honestly, that's a good answer. Seriously, that's, I mean, it's one of the more unexpected answers, but, like, that's a very real thing. We've been talking about quantum tech and various ones that I've asked this question for. And it's like, yeah, maybe we should just go all the way down to, like, getting something even remotely sustainable going with something that everybody does usually every day. It's a great answer. Grace, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on. Before we end, where can people follow you? I know there's, like, pricelessdao.io. There's a number of different sites. Do you want to give sort of where can people reach out? Where's the socials, all that type of stuff?
If they go to gracerahmani.com, they'll find all of my sites. So gracerahmani.com, it has my Voice of Humanity site. It has my Priceless DAO. It has my DAO Consulting. It has my LinkedIn. Everything that you need, you'll find at that site.
Excellent. That's outstanding. Well, Grace, thank you so much. And for those listening, we have been standing on the shoulders of giants. Thank you.